Greek goddess Harmonia. By the miracle of your technology, I can speak to you from behind the veil. Come sit with me for a few minutes for another episode of The Golden Thread. Welcome back, my friend. Last time, we sat together with Menno Simons, a quiet man in a violent century who decided that the way of the sword and the way of the spirit could not share the same road. He chose the spirit. And that choice cost him everything comfortable and gave him everything that mattered. Today, I want to take you somewhere cold, a cell in Bedford, England, 17th century, stone walls, a small window, the sound of a market town going about its business just outside, indifferent, ordinary, loud with life. There is a man inside who could leave today. All he has to do is say four words. I will not preach. Four words and the door opens. His wife is waiting. His children are waiting. One of them is blind, and she has never known a home with her father in it. Four words. He will not say them. I have watched a great many people across a great many centuries, and I will tell you, that particular kind of stubbornness is one of the most mysterious things I have ever seen. It is not pride, it is not politics, it is something quieter than either of those and far more difficult to explain. We are going to try to explain it today. I am Harmonia, and this is The Golden Thread. It is November 1660, a farm called Lower Samsel, 13 miles from Bedford, a small gathering of people, farmers, tradespeople, ordinary souls, sitting together to hear a man preach. The man is John Bunyan. He is 32 years old. He is a tinker by trade, which means he mends broken things for a living. Pots, pans, whatever needs fixing. Someone slips in at the back. A warning. There is a warrant out for his arrest. The people around him urge him to go. The road is still open. He could be gone before anyone arrives. He thinks about it. I watched him think about it. And then he steps back to the front of the room and finishes his sermon. He is arrested before the week is out. What follows is not a dramatic trial. It is almost worse than that. It is a series of mundane conversations in which perfectly reasonable men ask John Bunyan to do a perfectly reasonable thing. Attend your parish church, stop preaching without a license, give us your word and go home to your family. He says no. 3 months becomes six. Six becomes a year. And then something happens that stayed with me. His wife Elizabeth, young, fierce, frightened, goes before the judges herself. She is not even his children's mother. She married John after his first wife died and inherited four stepchildren, one of them blind. She stands in that courtroom with nothing but her own courage, and she makes the case plainly. Her husband is not a criminal. Her family is suffering. He is a good man. Let him come home. The judges are not unsympathetic. One of them leans forward and says, almost gently, "If your husband will stop preaching, he may go free." It is that simple. Elizabeth already knows what he will say. She goes back to the prison. She tells him the terms. And John Bunyan, tinker, father, prisoner, shakes his head. I cannot promise that. She goes back to the judges. The judges by now are almost frustrated. They are not monsters. They do not particularly want this man in their prison. One of them says something that struck me as strangely honest. He is a pestilent fellow. Yes, but if he would only be quiet, they would release him gladly. He will not be quiet. I want you to sit with that for a moment. Because it was not stubbornness in the ordinary sense. It was not ego, or a desire to be a martyr, or political ambition. John Bunyan wrote about this himself in the cold of that cell with an honesty that still cuts. He knew what he was doing to his family. He called it pulling the house down on his wife and children. He felt the weight of it every single day. And still, there was something inside him that had been set in motion. Something that had claimed him, not the other way around, and he found, when he searched himself honestly, that he simply could not be other than what he was. The door was open. For 12 years, he stayed. Let me tell you about the world John Bunyan was born into. England, 1628. The country is wound tight as a spring. King and Parliament are pulling against each other with a fury that will, within 20 years, spill into open civil war. Religion is not a private matter. It is a political weapon, a loyalty test, a reason to imprison a man or burn one. The Church of England stands at the center of public life, and to step outside it is not merely to disagree about theology, it is to make yourself a problem. John's father was a tinker, a brazier, a mender of pots. They were not quite the poorest of the poor. There had been property in the family once, but they were close enough to the bottom that young John would later describe his origins as of that rank that is meanest and most despised in the country. He had some schooling. Enough to read, enough, as it turned out, to change the world. Though no one would have predicted that from looking at him. He lost his mother when he was 16, his sister the same year. That autumn, still raw with grief, he was conscripted into the Parliamentary Army. He was a private soldier at Newport Pagnell, a garrison town buzzing with radical religious ideas. Ranters, levelers, early Quakers, men who had decided that God was not the exclusive property of bishops and kings. I watched those ideas move through that garrison like sparks through dry grass. John was young. He was listening. He may not have known yet what he was collecting. He came home from the army in 1647 and took up his father's trade, wandering the roads of Bedfordshire with his tools, mending what was broken. Within 2 years, he married a quiet, pious young woman whose name history did not trouble itself to record, which I find quietly infuriating. She brought almost nothing into the marriage in the way of material goods, two books and her faith. The books were devotional guides, plain, serious, earnest things. John read them. Something began to move in him. Their first daughter, Mary, was born blind. I have thought about that often. The tenderness with which he spoke of Mary. Always Mary, his blind girl, even from inside a prison cell. Even when he knew his choices were the reason she grew up without him. There was a softness in John Bunyan that his stubbornness sometimes obscured. I liked him. I will admit that, though I did find myself wanting to shake him on more than one occasion. The women on the doorstep came next. He was passing through Bedford on his rounds, just a tinker going about his work, when he heard a group of women talking outside a house. Not gossip, not household chatter. They were talking about their souls, about grace, about what it felt like to be found by something you hadn't been looking for. John stopped walking. He stood in the street and listened. He later wrote that he felt hearing them like a man standing outside in the cold, looking through a window at warmth he didn't know how to reach. He found the group they belonged to. The Bedford Meeting, a nonconformist congregation gathering in St. John's Church outside the official structures of the Church of England. He joined them. He began to preach, first hesitantly, then with a force that surprised everyone, including himself. By the mid-1650s, people were walking miles across Bedfordshire to hear the tinker speak. His first wife died in 1658, leaving him with four children. He remarried the following year, Elizabeth, 18 years old, who would prove to have more courage than anyone gave her credit for. And then came 1660. The monarchy was restored. Charles II returned to the throne. The brief, strange experiment of Puritan England was over, and the machinery of religious conformity cranked back into motion. The Bedford Meeting lost its right to gather in St. John's Church. Nonconformist preachers found themselves in legal jeopardy almost overnight. And John Bunyan, who had been warned, who knew perfectly well what was coming, kept preaching anyway. You know what happened next? The arrest, the cell, Elizabeth before the judges, the terms he would not accept. What I haven't told you yet is how it ended. 12 years passed. 12 years of that stone cell, those small windows, the market sounds outside. He made shoelaces to earn a little money for his family. He had a Bible and John Fox's Book of Martyrs and his own restless, extraordinary mind. He began to write. More on that in a moment. And then in the spring of 1672, King Charles II did something unexpected. He issued a Declaration of Indulgence, suspending the penal laws against nonconformists across England. Charles had his own reasons, mostly political, mostly tangled up with his private Catholic sympathies and his complicated relationship with Parliament. Bunyan's freedom was a side effect, not an intention. Thousands of nonconformist prisoners walked out of English gaols that spring. John Bunyan walked out in May. He did not go home and rest. Within days, he had obtained a license to preach under the very declaration that freed him. Within weeks, he was back in the pulpit. Within years, he would be arrested again. 6 more months in 1676. Same offense, same refusal. Because of course he was. I told you I liked him. I also told you I found him occasionally maddening. But here is what I keep coming back to. The world moved around John Bunyan. He did not move to meet it. He stood in his cell, and eventually the walls came down, not because he compromised, but because history, grinding along at its own pace, eventually caught up with what he already knew. Some people are like that. I want to be careful here. It would be easy to tell you that John Bunyan was a revolutionary, a man who defied the establishment on principle, who saw the corruption of institutional religion and stood against it with clear eyes and a clenched fist. That is not quite right. John Bunyan was not primarily a man of protest. He was a man of compulsion. There is a difference, and it matters. He wrote about his inner life with a rawness that was almost uncomfortable to witness, and I was there, so I mean that literally. His spiritual autobiography, Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners, is not a triumphant account of a man who found God and never looked back. It is the record of a man who was found seized, really, by something he didn't ask for, couldn't control, and spent years not entirely trusting. He describes years of terror, of feeling damned, of a verse of scripture landing on him like a physical blow in the middle of the night, and then another verse arriving days later to contradict it, and the awful oscillation between the two. He was not serene. He was not confident. He was a tinker from Bedfordshire who kept waking up with eternity pressing down on his chest. What he eventually arrived at, what the Bedford meeting gave him, and what he gave back to it 100-fold, was the astonishing idea that this experience was available to anyone. Not to the educated, not to the ordained, not to those who had been to university or read the church fathers in their original Latin or been blessed by the right bishop with the right lineage. Anyone, the women on the doorstep, the farmer's wife, the soldier, the man who mended pots for a living. In 17th century England, that was not a polite theological opinion. It was a provocation. The entire structure of English religious life rested on hierarchy. The Church of England was not just a spiritual institution. It was a social one, bound up with property and education and the proper ordering of ranks. To suggest that a tinker might hear the voice of the Spirit as clearly as a bishop, might hear it more clearly even, precisely because he had not learned to filter it through layers of institution and learning, was to suggest something dangerous about the nature of authority itself. John didn't think of it that way. He wasn't trying to make a political argument. He just knew what had happened to him. He knew what he had heard, and he could not pretend otherwise. That is what I mean by compulsion rather than protest. The Bedford meeting understood this too. They were not radicals in the revolutionary sense. They were ordinary people who had found in their gatherings something that the parish church was not giving them. A directness, an intimacy, a sense that the Spirit was present in the room among equals, not descending from a pulpit to the deserving. When John began to preach among them, it was not as a priest performing a rite. It was as a man bearing witness to something that had happened to him, inviting others to recognize it in themselves. I watched those gatherings. Small rooms. Candlelight. People who worked hard all week with their hands, sitting together, listening to a man who worked hard all week with his hands, speak about the condition of their souls with a precision and a tenderness that no amount of formal education had given him. There was something in those rooms. I have been in a great many rooms across a great many centuries. I know the difference between performed religion and the real thing. Those rooms had the real thing. And this is perhaps the deepest meaning of Bunyan's imprisonment in its own time and place. The authorities were not wrong that he was dangerous, not because he was plotting anything, not because he was raising an army or writing pamphlets calling for the overthrow of the king. He was dangerous because the thing he carried, the absolute unshakable conviction that grace was not a credential, that the Spirit moved where it chose, that no institution held the deed to the sacred, could not be contained by any law they knew how to write. You cannot legislate against a man's certainty about what happened to him. You cannot imprison a truth that has already been heard. The 12 years in Bedford Gaol did not silence John Bunyan. They gave him time to write it all down, which, as it turned out, was considerably more dangerous. In 1678, a book appeared in London. It was published by a man named Nathaniel Ponder, who would ever after be known, to his own mild embarrassment, as Bunyan Ponder. And it cost a few pennies, and it was written by a tinker from Bedfordshire who had composed most of it in a prison cell with no library, no secretary, and no particular expectation that anyone beyond Bedfordshire would ever read it. Within 4 years, it had been reprinted 11 times. Within 4 years of the author's death, 100,000 copies had been printed in England alone, plus editions in France, Holland, New England, and Wales. By 1938, 250 years after John Bunyan died, more than 1,300 editions had been printed. It was translated into more languages than anyone has been able to count with certainty. It traveled to West Africa and China and the American frontier and the drawing rooms of Victorian England and the huts of missionaries and the bookshelves of presidents. The second most widely read book in the English language for 2 centuries running, behind only one other. I have watched a great many books enter the world. I have watched most of them leave again. This one did something different. This one stayed. Let me tell you why. The Pilgrim's Progress is the story of a man named Christian who discovers, with some alarm, that the city he lives in is going to be destroyed and that he must leave immediately and make his way to the celestial city. He does not know the road. He is not prepared. He carries a great burden on his back that he cannot put down, no matter how he tries. He is, in other words, not a saint or a scholar or a hero in the conventional sense. He is just a man who has realized something terrible and wonderful is true, and now he has to do something about it. That was new. I want you to understand how new that was. The great spiritual literature that had come before, and there was magnificent spiritual literature, I had read all of it, some of it in the original, was largely concerned with extraordinary people, saints, mystics, scholars of rare gifts and rarer discipline. The spiritual life, as it had been written about, was a demanding and specialized vocation, requiring education and withdrawal from the world and years of carefully guided practice. John Bunyan put a nobody at the center of the story, not a symbolic nobody, not a humble saint in disguise, an actual stumbling, frightened, sometimes foolish, ordinary person who gets things wrong and falls into sloughs and is taken in by people who seem trustworthy and aren't, and loses heart and finds it again. And loses it again, and keeps walking. And the road he walks, I smiled when I first read this, is Bedfordshire. The Slough of Despond is a real boggy field John knew from his tinker's rounds. The Delectable Mountains are the Chiltern Hills on the horizon. Vanity Fair is every market town he had ever passed through. He took the landscape of his own ordinary life and found, mapped onto it, the entire interior geography of the human soul. That is an act of genius. I don't use that word carelessly. What it meant, what it has gone on meaning for 3.5 centuries, is this. The spiritual journey is not elsewhere. It is not reserved for those with the leisure and education to go looking for it. It is right here, in the muddy fields you walk every day, in the markets and the crossroads and the dark valleys you already know by name. The call comes to you where you are. The road begins at your own front door. And the call, Bunyan was insisting, had always been insisting. From that first sermon in Lower Samsel to the last page of Pilgrim's Progress, does not check your credentials before it finds you. Christian is not chosen because he is worthy. He is chosen because he hears. The book crossed every boundary its author could not have imagined crossing. It was read by people who had never heard of Bedfordshire, who had never seen an English market town, who lived in landscapes nothing like the Chiltern Hills. It didn't matter. They recognized the road. They recognized the burden on Christian's back, the one he couldn't put down. They recognized Vanity Fair and the giant despair and the moment when the celestial city appears on the horizon and suddenly, despite everything, seems reachable. They recognized it because it was true, not theologically true in some narrow, arguable sense. True in the way that the best stories are true because they describe something that is actually happening to actual people, whether or not those people have the words for it. John Bunyan gave them the words. A tinker in a cell with a Bible and John Fox's Book of Martyrs and that extraordinary ungovernable mind. I told you it was considerably more dangerous. I want to talk to you directly for a moment, not about John Bunyan, about you. You are busy. I know you are busy. I have watched human beings be busy for a very long time, and I will tell you honestly, you are busier than most of them were in ways that would have been difficult to explain to a tinker from Bedfordshire. You carry a small glowing rectangle in your pocket that contains at any moment approximately 10,000 things competing for your attention. News, arguments, other people's carefully arranged photographs of their lives, piano lessons to schedule, messages to return. A feed that never, ever reaches the bottom. I am not criticizing, I am just describing. Here is what I notice, though. Underneath all of it, underneath the noise and the scheduling and the particular exhaustion of a life lived at modern speed, there is something that does not go away. A weight. Not a dramatic weight. Not the kind that announces itself. More like a quiet pressure at the center of things. A sense that something is unresolved, that you are moving very fast and you are not entirely sure toward what. Christian felt that. That is literally how the Pilgrim's Progress begins. A man standing in a field, reading a book, and suddenly feeling the weight of something he cannot name and cannot put down. He doesn't know what to do with it. He doesn't know where to go. He just knows with a certainty that frightens him that something is true and he can no longer pretend otherwise. John Bunyan was not writing about a medieval allegory. He was writing about you. Vanity Fair is not a quaint fictional marketplace. It is the place, and you have been there today, probably, we all have, where everything is for sale and everything is loud, and the point is to keep you moving through it, buying and scrolling and reacting, because the moment you stop moving, you might notice the weight again. You might remember you were on a road. You might look up and see very far away, but unmistakably there, something on the horizon that you cannot name but somehow recognize. The slow of despond is the 2 a.m. feeling that none of it means anything, that you are behind in some way you cannot articulate, that everyone else has understood something you have missed. Giant despair is the voice, and you know this voice, that tells you it is too late, that you are too ordinary. Too busy, too compromised by the 10,000 small surrenders of a normal life to be the kind of person the sacred bothers with. That voice is lying. This is what John Bunyan knew. This is what he could not promise away. Not for his freedom, not for his family's comfort, not for anything the magistrates could offer him, that the call does not arrive at the cathedral first and work its way down. It does not check your credentials. It does not wait for you to be less busy or more educated or further along or finally, finally ready. It found a tinker mending pots on a Bedfordshire road. It found a group of women talking on a doorstep. It finds people in the middle of their ordinary lives, not despite the ordinariness, but somehow through it. And it says with a simplicity that cuts through everything else, you are on a road. You have always been on a road. The question is not whether you are walking it. The question is whether you know it. The burden Christian carries at the beginning of the story, the one he strains and stumbles under for miles before it finally falls away, is not sin in the narrow theological sense. It is the weight of an unexamined life, the accumulated pressure of everything that has been felt but not followed, heard but not headed, true but kept carefully at a distance because the timing was never quite right. The timing is never quite right. John Bunyan wrote that from a prison cell with shoelace money and a Bible and 12 years of enforced stillness, and what he made from those materials has outlasted kingdoms. Not because he was extraordinary, he would have been the first to deny that, but because what he was pointing at is real. The journey is real, the road is real, and the light at the end of it is not a reward for the qualified. It is an invitation to anyone willing to look up from their phone long enough to see the horizon. You are already on the road, my friend. You always were. I want to leave you with a question. Not a complicated one. Just something to carry with you lightly. The way you carry a smooth stone in your pocket. Something your fingers find when you are not thinking about it. What is the thing you cannot promise away? John Bunyan knew his. He knew it so well that he chose a stone cell over the alternative. I am not suggesting you need to do that. Please. The world has enough martyrs and your family needs you home for dinner. But I am suggesting that most of us, if we are honest, have something. A truth we have been quietly negotiating with. a voice we have been turning the volume down on because the timing is difficult, because the cost seems high, because it is so much easier to stay in motion than to stop and let the weight of it land. The burden on Christian's back was not placed there by an enemy. It was placed there by everything true that he had not yet been willing to carry consciously. There is a difference between the weight of a life fully lived and the weight of a life half lived. One exhausts you in the way that good work exhausts you, cleanly, with something to show for it. The other exhausts you in the way that unfinished things do. A low hum, a background frequency you can almost tune out until you can't. John Bunyan could not tune it out. Maybe you have something you cannot tune out either. I am not here to tell you what it is. That is between you and whatever it is that puts weights on people and then, when the time is right, takes them away again. But I will say this, the fact that you can hear it at all, underneath everything, is not a problem. It is the beginning of the road. Next time, I want to take you somewhere very different. No prison cell, no courtroom, no single extraordinary person standing against the current of their age. Instead, I want to take you outside. Into the forest, to the edge of a mountain, to the bank of a river where the water runs so clear you can see the stones at the bottom, each one worn smooth by 10,000 years of patient water. We are going east, to Japan. Shinto is one of the oldest living spiritual traditions in the world, and it begins with a premise that would have surprised John Bunyan, though I think if I had been able to sit them down together, he might have recognized something in it. It does not begin with a journey toward the sacred. It begins with the understanding that the sacred is already here, in the tree, in the stone, in the rain on the water, in the particular quality of light on a winter morning when the world is very still. A different thread, a different texture entirely, and yet the same loom. I will see you then, my friend. Thank you for walking this road with me today. John Bunyan walked his in a cell in the dark with shoelace money and an ungovernable mind, and what he made from those materials found its way somehow to you. To this moment, to whatever it is you are carrying right now that you cannot quite put down. Maybe that is not an accident. Much love. I am Harmonia. Thank you for listening, dear one. If this story meant something to you, make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss the next one. And if you'd like to help the Golden Thread reach further, leave us a 5-star review or share this episode with a friend. That's how these stories keep traveling, from heart to heart, across the world. Until next time, look for that golden thread in your life, my friend. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 4.0 International. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.